Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News, now in depth on the high stakes of Republican health care. GOP senators will go home to 4th of July parades and fireworks shows without a repeal vote on Obamacare to tout to their constituents. That's because although Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell vowed to hold a vote on the Senate health care bill by the 4th of July recess, he couldn't find enough Republicans to support it. He's also aware that the bill, the way it's written, is not popular among Americans at large. At least that's what recent polls say about it. Democratic Minority Leader Chuck Schumer said yesterday, the Senate health care bill is rotten to the core. As our guests join us to talk about it, I want to know what we should really understand about this bill, what it actually does, and I want to hear from you on this. Do you believe Republicans are on the right track in repealing and replacing Obamacare? Do you believe Obamacare could have and should have been improved and still might be? What needs fixing, in your view? So maybe this comes out of your own experience with your health insurance, whether it comes from employers or whether you're on the Minnesota Health Exchange. Talk to me today about what, in your view, needs fixing. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. I'm on Twitter at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I, NPR. We'll have two guests to join us here in just a minute, but I want to start with Jennifer Habercorn. She's a senior healthcare reporter for Politico, and she's with us from Washington to tell us kind of what happens next. Jennifer, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Can you tell me what the Senate Majority Leader can do to find votes in the next 10 days that he couldn't do in the 4 to 5 weeks that they were quietly working on this bill?
Well, Mitch McConnell, the majority leader, is the only one who really knows what that can be. I mean, right now we have moderates who want to pull the bill toward the middle, the political middle. They are worried about people with pre-existing conditions. They're worried about people on Medicaid who would lose coverage under this bill. And at the other end of the spectrum, you have conservatives who don't like the bill either. They argue that it doesn't repeal enough of the Affordable Care Act and that, you know, this is why Republicans were elected to the House, the Senate, and the White House to repeal the Affordable Care Act. So McConnell needs to find a way to get some of those moderates and some of those conservatives back into the fold. But if you think of this bill like a balloon and you push one side in, you lose people on the other side. Mm-hmm. And right now he has 52 Republicans. He needs 50 to support a bill to get it through the Senate. And we're counting at least five who said before the vote was pulled that they wouldn't support it. After the bill was pulled, even more came out and said they wouldn't have supported it.
Do you think that he counted on the objections to what they want to do with Medicaid? And I'll just remind listeners again that many of the people who are on Medicaid are children, and they are elderly who have run out of money for long-term care, and so they're using Medicaid for that. Did McConnell reckon with how that was going to be viewed?
Yeah, it was pretty known. I mean, there were several Republican senators from states that expanded Medicaid that said early on that they were very concerned. The Affordable Care Act expanded Medicaid from those folks who were talking about children and elderly into adults without children. And in those states, those Republican senators don't want to have to tell their governor that they're going to have to kick a whole bunch of people out of Medicaid. And obviously, no politician wants to be the one to have to do that. So those Republican senators from those expansion states, such as Rob Portman from Ohio, Shelley Moore Capito from West Virginia, they were pretty vocal all along that this was going to be a big concern of theirs. They don't want to see the Medicaid program cut. And it is something that McConnell has dealt with publicly.
Okay.
But the issue is conservatives want to see Medicaid reined in.
I mean, I read the piece today in the Times about how the two governors, Hickenlooper and Kasich, were instrumental also in
in delaying the vote. And this kind of explains why Cory Gardner out of Colorado and Portman, as you say, have been raising objections. You wrote a story last week that said Republican leaders believe that entering the July 4th recess with their Obamacare quagmire unsolved could lose votes as well as hurt the GOP politically. But the rushed timeline could put rank-and-file Republicans in a tough spot with little time to deliberate such a consequential vote. Well, now they're about to do that scenario that you laid out. What will it mean? What will happen?
Well, it'll mean lawmakers will be home for another recess. And Democratic activists who support the ACA have already said, you know, go to lawmakers' barbecues and 4th of July parades and tell them how much you don't want the Affordable Care Act repealed. And so, you know, many Republican senators after the meeting yesterday said that they do acknowledge that they're going to have another week of folks, you know, coming up to them and asking them not to repeal the Affordable Care Act. You know, it's interesting that support for the ACA has risen only in recent weeks once repeal has become a real possibility. And, you know, lawmakers work ahead of a recess. Nothing rarely gets done until right before lawmakers go home for a break. And that next recess now is going to be the August recess when they go home for a whole month. And that's kind of when Washington resets its agenda. There's very little reason to think that if this isn't done before the August recess, that they're going to come back in September and be able to get their, you know, 7-year campaign promise to repeal Obamacare.
Wow. Jennifer, does the August recess just start on August 1, just so we have our timeline straight here?
Yes. Whatever that weekend is, that last weekend in July, they typically go home. I think it would start July 28th.
Okay. Wow. Hey, we have a question for you on Twitter from Chris, who says, I'd like to learn about major amendments that are being proposed that may make passage more likely after the July break. Are there major amendments in the mix right now, Jennifer?
Yeah, they're not technically amendments. Instead, it's things that certain lawmakers are pushing for. You have the folks from Medicaid states, like we mentioned, Portman and Capito, who are pushing for more money to go into Medicaid. They're also, coincidentally, pushing for more funding for the opioid crisis. And that's a major concern for both of those senators, as well as other senators from states that have really been hit hard from the opioid crisis. Then there's also amendments being pushed by conservatives. Ted Cruz and Mike Lee want to see the ability to sell across state lines. There's some issue whether Senate rules would actually allow that, but that's something that they really want. Senator Ron Johnson has joined with them. They want to see the states being allowed to opt out of guaranteed issue, which is Obamacare's perhaps most popular requirement,
right,
that insurance companies can't deny you or charge you more because of pre-existing conditions.
Well, I mean, that is really the whole, that's one of the essential tenets of Obamacare.
That's right.
I was under the impression that the House bill allows that. The Senate does not?
That's right. The House bill would have allowed it. They would have allowed insurance companies to charge you more. The Senate bill does not. The vast majority of Republican senators don't want to touch that. They want to keep it as it is under the Affordable Care Act. You know, because it's so politically popular, they feel like they cannot go home having voted for a bill that would do that. But there are certain Republicans who argue that one of the major reasons premiums have gone up is because you have that expensive requirement that insurers accept everybody.
Hmm. I'll ask our two guests about that. To a call for you here, Jennifer, from Susan in Minneapolis. Susan, what are you thinking about?
So what I'm thinking is that our legislators, both Democrats and Republicans, are so out of touch with what their constituents really want in health care. And that is, rather than Republicans going into a room and figuring it out all by themselves, the optics of that were bad from the get-go. If they could get together, and I know this sounds insane, but if they could get together in a room, a bipartisan group, women and men from both parties, take some time to carefully and thoughtfully hammer out some kind of healthcare program, brand it something completely different if they want. But if they could, I'm sorry, crazy, work together, I think they would find that they would be less hostile reception when they got home.
Jennifer, what kind of a dream world is Susan living in here?
Unfortunately, it's quite a dream world. There was one group of senators that did meet a couple weeks ago. It was led by Susan Collins and Bill Cassidy. Collins, the most moderate Republican from Maine, Cassidy from Louisiana. They got together, a group of Republicans and Democrats, and just kind of tested the waters to see if a bipartisan bill would be possible. Most folks left that meeting saying that it was great that they tried, but they don't see it happening, particularly while this Republican-only bill is still in the air. There is some thought that if this bill were to die, that you know some bipartisan attempt could come from the ashes. I have a little bit of a hard time seeing that happening soon, just because Republicans and Democrats have both been so entrenched in their political camps for so long on the Affordable Care Act. I think it would take a little bit of time for some kind of true bipartisan repair to come out of it.
So just on the politics and the timing of this, do you think it's the week of July 10th that they try again, or will it take them more time?
That's what Mitch McConnell wants. His goal right now is to get a political compromise by the end of the week, to have that bill written, to use the 4th of July break to get it fully drafted and scored by the Congressional Budget Office, mm-hmm. and then come back that week of July 10th and have a vote. That seems very ambitious, just judging where lawmakers are right now. You know, there's not a clear path forward on what that political compromise would look like, but that's what the majority leader wants to try to do.
Jennifer, I know you've been super busy over the last few days. Thank you so much for the time. We're really grateful for it.
It was great to talk with you. Thank you.
Jennifer Haber-Korn is senior healthcare reporter for Politico, kind of giving us the inside scoop there on from Capitol Hill on this. Turning to two guests now, Gerald Kaminsky is with us. He's a professor at UCLA's Department of Health Policy and Management, and with us today from L.A. Gerald, welcome back. It's good to have you on the show.
Thank you very much, Carrie.
Ovik Roy is with us, president of the Foundation for Research on Equal Opportunity, and he's with us today from Austin, Texas. And Ovik, welcome to you. It's good to have you on the show.
Hey, how are you?
Ovik, I want to ask you about something that Jennifer said about the argument from conservatives that says the reason the health bill is expensive is because insurers are required to ensure pre-existing conditions and that the math would work better if that wasn't in there. Do you agree with that?
I agree with that in part in the sense that effectively those kinds of regulations have the end result of while they make health insurance a little bit more affordable for people who are already sick, they make health insurance less affordable for people who are healthy. And so to the degree that healthy people drop out of the market and therefore the average costs, the average health status of people in the risk pool is worse, premiums go up. So that is true. However, there are also arguments that a lot of people make, including the supporters of the Affordable Care Act, that that's a price worth paying to make sure that people who are already sick can afford health insurance. And the Senate bill, as Jennifer noted, accounts for that point of view. It's a Senate bill that preserves the ACA's provisions with regard to pre-existing conditions.
And Gerald, to follow on that, Ovik mentioned the risk pool, and it is true that the risk pool was never really in balance from the beginning of the ACA, isn't it?
No, I don't think that that's true at all.
Really?
There has been variation across the country, but California, for example, the risk pool is quite healthy, and it's gotten better over the last 3 years. So I think the problem is that Minnesota, for example, it appears that there have been problems, and that's one of the reasons that premiums went up so high this past year in the state. But it varies across the country, and in some of the smaller markets, when you have it can only take a handful of people who have really bad experience in a year to drive premiums up for everybody. If you've got a market that's been divided among 7 or 8 different insurers, and you know you have 3 or 4,000 people in the marketplace, it takes one sick person to cause premiums to go up.
I was under the impression that they never got enough of those so-called young invincibles, which happened in Minnesota, as you note, and happened in a lot of states.
Yeah.
And that is why the risk pool was out of balance, and that is part of the reason that Republicans want to get rid of that individual mandate. I know what they have measures to try to encourage, to incentivize people to get insurance. But I thought that was part of the reason that the individual mandate was so important to the ACA.
It is one of the reasons that it was important. What I'm saying is that overall, the experience in terms of enrolling a younger and healthier mix of patients, the experience has varied across the country. And some states have done quite well in having a balanced risk pool. Other states have not done quite as well.
Okay, let me take some calls here for both of you to Steve in Eden Prairie. Hi, Steve.
Hi.
What are you thinking about here as far as where the Affordable Health Care Act and then the Republican version of this goes?
I don't think too much of the Republican version. What I'd like to see, I'm a father of three kids and a wife, and they're teenagers. I've seen a lot of health bills in my life. And I'd like to see some standardization of the health care plans. For instance, I don't buy a Ford car, can only drive in Ford roads. The roads are standardized, Wi-Fi standardized. Why can't we standardize in the plans? There seems to be a lot of administrative overhead and just taking care of each custom interaction every time a patient walks into a health care facility.
Oh, Vic, does that make sense to you? The possibility of being able to do that?
Well, we certainly can do certain things to standardize plans. The ACA does certain things to standardize plans. The Republican bill has a different approach to standardization, but they both have some standardization. But at the same time, you know, the caller mentions, well, you know, there should be standardization in terms of a Ford car can drive on all sorts of different roads. But let's also remember that you can also buy 1,000 different types of cars, right? So standardization is helpful, but it's also helpful to think about exactly what kind of standardization. So to the degree that the Affordable Care Act standardizes or regulates the type of insurance you can buy, the flip side of that is that that means there are fewer options that might be more affordable or better suited to your needs. But we do have the insurance plans you can get through those Affordable Care Act exchanges do allow you to, generally speaking, get health care from a broad range of physicians and hospitals that offer health care services. So in that sense, with the caller's analogy, the Ford car can drive on a lot of different roads. So I'd say the things that are important to do, and particularly in the individual insurance market, the market for people who shop for coverage on their own, and we have to make sure that people understand that about 15% of Americans participate in that market. The vast majority of Americans get coverage through their employer or the government. They're not shopping for coverage on their own in the way that that we're talking about, that the Affordable Care Act in particular plays a role in impacting. And in that market, that individual market for health insurance, I think there is you do want to help people kind of wade through the fine print and make sure that insurers can't kind of gyp them retroactively through fine print language. So I think in that sense, a bit of standardization is helpful. But I think if we press too hard on standardization, we limit the options for insurance plans to innovate and for people to actually choose the kind of health coverage they really want.
Gerald, given what Ovik just said about the percentage, and that's a pretty small percentage, right, that are enrolled in, you know, an exchange or enrolled through Obamacare, aren't a lot of the problems that people perceive to have with the ACA also afflicting health care insurance in general?
To a certain extent, that is true. But just the pure number of people who were covered by Obamacare in the individual markets is a relatively small portion of the market,
right,
compared to the large group market. And we're not seeing the same disruptions in the large group market right now that we're seeing in the exchanges. Those markets are relatively stable. And in fact, the underlying goal of the Affordable Care Act was to primarily leave the large group market alone. I think the thinking at the time by the designers of the law was that the large group market more or less is functioning well. We're not going to impose a lot of regulations. We're going to have some standards. We're going to require large employers to provide preventive services at no cost. We're going to put we're going to eliminate lifetime and annual limits on benefits. But, for example, essential health benefits, standardization of policies, none of that applied to the large group market. So I think that that market has continued to function relatively stably, and it is subject to premium increases as healthcare spending goes up.
Exactly.
But we're not seeing insurers flee those markets the way we are in the exchanges right now because of all the political uncertainty.
That's what I was going to ask you about. More generally, if I do a show, as we often do, about how people feel about the quality and the cost of their health care in general, I hear a lot about, I've got such a high deductible, I don't want to use my health care, my co-pays. I mean, it seems like a lot of this still comes back to that debate that maybe we haven't had yet, which is how much are we willing to cost share for our health care? Is that something that you'd say applies across the board?
I think so. And I think that's an excellent point that you're making, that some of the issues that we're dealing with in ACA markets are the same issues that we have dealt with. We've seen an increasing trend over the last decade of more and more high deductible plans across all markets, more cost sharing, higher co-payments. And that is what leads to an overall sense that, you know, I'm paying more for health care and getting less.
Right. And Ovik, do you think that is a debate we've had yet and should have?
No, we haven't had that debate. We didn't have it when the ACA was passed. It was sort of kicked, that can was kicked down the road. Certainly, the Republicans have no interest in having this discussion or debate, because what you're raising is the overall issue of health care spending in the United States, and no one is really tackling that.
Ovik, why haven't we had that debate, and should we? Ovik, are you there? Oh, we might have lost him. Let's go to the phone.
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Oh, go ahead. Yeah, now I can.
Sorry.
Did you hear
okay.
my question?
Sorry about that. Yeah.
Okay.
So, I think actually Republicans have been raising the cost issue in a lot of their commentary. In terms of the premiums in the Affordable Care Act exchanges, to the degree that that's one element of the overall problem of healthcare costs. They have been talking about that a lot, and a lot of what senators in particular, in terms of what they want to do to improve this bill. I think a big focus of theirs is that they want to deliver on that promise to get the premiums lower in the Affordable Care Act exchanges. To the uh-huh. point about the broader healthcare system, one thing I think, you know, personally, I think they've gone in the wrong direction in this bill, is they've delayed the onset of Obamacare's Cadillac tax. Obamacare has this Cadillac tax on high-cost employer-based health insurance that was meant to kick in originally in 2018.
These are people that get very expensive kind of packages, right?
Very expensive, sort of in the top 5 percentile, shall we say, of employer-based coverage in terms of the economic value of it. And the idea behind Obamacare, or in terms of this particular tax, was that nearly all experts believe that the unlimited tax break for employer-based coverage is a major driver of healthcare inflation, because it encourages employers to cover very expensive services and tolerate the high prices that hospitals and doctors and drug companies charge. So the Cadillac tax is an attempt to do something about that. And that's one of my favorite provisions in the Affordable Care Act. So I regret that that Republicans have diluted that further. So that, I think that's one thing where they're going backwards on cost. One area where the Republican bill is neutral relative to the ACA is the Affordable Care Act reduced Medicare spending by mm-hmm. $850 billion over a 10-year period. The Republican bill does not change that in one direction or the other, mainly because the president doesn't want to touch Medicare, and the reconciliation process that the Republican senators are using doesn't allow you to touch Medicare. So Medicare and employer-based coverage are big drivers of cost, and by and large, we're not really making a lot of difference there.
I just have to ask, and then I promise to go to the phones here. So, Gerald, why was Medicare kind of the third rail, but Medicaid was not, because there are big changes to Medicaid.
I think the simple answer is a political one.
It's politics.
Medicaid beneficiaries are low-income individuals. Not exclusively, but primarily. A significant portion of Medicaid recipients are also parents and grandparents who spend their assets. They're in nursing homes. They spend all of their assets and then become eligible for state funding. My mother in Maryland is in the process of going through this, and she's in a retirement community and is spending her life savings and will qualify for Medicaid within the next 20 months or so. So this is the beneficiaries on this program are not do not have a strong political voice, have never had a strong political voice. The Medicare program is just the opposite.
Ovik, I have to come back to you on that, which is what I find puzzling here. You know, we are hearing members of the administration and who support the Republican bill say, well, a lot of these people on Medicaid, they're able-bodied, they can go get work, and then their employers will cover their health care. But we know that many, many of the Medicaid recipients are kids and the people that Gerald just described, right? People who have spent down their assets for long-term care, and now they're on Medicaid for that. So I'm puzzled as to why Medicaid has been the big target on this.
So it's very important to understand that the Medicaid cuts in the Senate bill have two major components. The first is the repeal of the Affordable Care Act's expansion of Medicaid, and the second is the per capita cap reform, which puts the legacy traditional Medicaid program on a budget. This is an idea that was originally proposed by Bill Clinton in 1995. So the vast majority, depending on what you think the future of Medicaid spending is going to look like under normal circumstances, under current law, something like 85 to 95% of the reductions in Medicare spending in the future are driven by that first category, the repeal of the ACA's Medicaid expansion. And the remainder is the legacy program. So the reason I'm bringing that up is that the repeal of the Medicaid expansion under the Senate bill is replaced by extending the ability of people to buy tax credits on what you might call the new exchanges to that population. So those individuals who are no longer going to be on Medicaid are going to have the opportunity to buy coverage in the private market using pretty robust and generous premium subsidies.
But the children and the elderly are not going to. Use those tax credits, are they?
Well, the people who are on the legacy Medicaid program, their Medicaid is not changed by that provision, right? Because they're not affected by the expansion. They are participants in the per capita cap or block grant
until the money is limited, right? Because it's capped through these block grants.
It's a little bit more subtle than that, because it's not so much exactly capped in that, you know, there's certain flexibility and variations, but the inflators that are used in terms of what the growth rate of future Medicaid spending is. So you mentioned the elderly, for example. The cap for the vast majority of the 10-year period is the medical inflation plus 1%, which is actually a significantly higher rate than per enrollee spending has been on the elderly over historically, and also what the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services projects for the next 5 to 10 years. So while you're putting it on a budget, that particular piece is not really going to have that significant effect, which is, in fact, why conservative senators like Senator Pat Toomey from Pennsylvania have been complaining about it. They've been complaining that while there is this per capita cap, you know, in theory in the bill, the actual effect on spending from that per capita cap is minimal to none.
It's also the reason Rob Portman in Ohio is worried about it, because Ohio is one of the states under a Republican governor that expanded Medicaid to cover more health insurance.
He's worried about both pieces, but he's more worried about the rollback of the Medicaid expansion,
right?
Because which is the first category, not the second category, right? So the first, it's very important for your listeners to understand these two different pieces of the Medicaid reforms in the Senate bill, because they affect different populations And the magnitude of the effect and the category of the effect is considerably different.
I hear you on that. Gerald, do you want to add something to that before we go to the calls?
Yeah, I'm not sure that I completely agree. I agree that there are two different effects going on here. One is I want to clarify, the expansion population is not being eliminated. The enhanced funding for that group is being eliminated. So states will be eligible for whatever their matching funds were or their matching rate under the Medicaid program prior to the ACA. They'll be eligible for that for the expansion population.
Mm-hmm.
So the funding for that isn't going away. My understanding is that most of the savings from the Medicaid provisions of this bill and House bill will come from the cap. And the fact is the cap is tied to a rate that will grow much more slowly than average healthcare spending. And so what that does over time is it guarantees that the Medicaid program will shrink relative to its current status and will force states to make difficult
decisions. Okay, I want to rephrase that for a second just so we understand that. The limits on the block grants, the Medicaid block grants that are going to states, those limits are going to grow more slowly than the cost of health care. And so the cost of health care, you believe, will exceed the Medicaid money that's being supplied to the states.
They are tied to, depending on which bill, let's talk about the Senate bill, tied to CPI. I just want to make sure, medical CPI. But medical CPI or medical CPI plus one for the elderly for a period from 2020 to 2024. After 2025, it will be tied to just the CPI.
Okay.
And that grows. You can look at historical data. That has always grown more slowly than healthcare spending.
Okay.
And that's the goal.
Let me get a call in. Again, acknowledging that this is really complicated stuff, and I don't want to simplify it too much, but I want to make sure we're not using the kind of language that is impenetrable to those of us who aren't steeped in this, to Janet in St. Paul. Hi, Janet. Thanks so much for waiting.
Hi. Near the end of his life, Martin Luther King said that discrimination and lack of access in health care was one of the most harmful parts of discrimination. Medicare and Medicaid were actually seen as pieces of civil rights legislation. The ACA brought many people of color into health care access, and to the extent that this is rolled back, if benefits are less generous, it will be, I think, yet another defeat for racial equality in our country.
Janet, I appreciate the call and the thoughts. To Peter in St. Paul. Hi, Peter. What's your take on this?
Yeah, well, I was just curious. You've been talking a lot about insurance, which to me sounds like the back end of healthcare costs. And I was wondering if there's anything being done on the front end to reduce the cost of healthcare itself. Because, with an aging population, I'm not sure if it'll ever be a fully balanced market.
Okay, that's a really good question, and we're going to take it up after we get a look at the latest news. I'll ask our guests whether the ACA did much to manage health care costs, and then we'll go to Peter's question on that. If you've tuned into the conversation, working our way through the complexities of the Senate health care bill, the vote has been delayed until at least the week of July 10th, trying to understand what this bill means, the measures of it, how it meets the House bill, and then how it differs from the Affordable Care Act, commonly known as Obamacare. Ovik Roy is with us. He's president of the Foundation for Research on Equal Opportunity, and Gerald Kaminsky is with us from UCLA's Department of Health Policy and Management. Questions, welcome here. 651-227-6000. If you get a busy signal, try me on Twitter. It's at Kerry, KerriMPR. And I want to say this. I understand that there's a lot of political opinioneering going on here. But if you have just actual questions about the details of this, I'm going to give you priority because at the moment we're trying to understand this. Let me take a break here for the latest news. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Carrie. President Trump is taking issue with a New York Times story that portrays him as disengaged in the push for a GOP health care bill. The Times also reported an unidentified senator who left a White House meeting with the president did not think Trump understood the Senate bill. This morning, Trump tweeted, "Some of the fake news media likes to say that I am not totally engaged in health care. Wrong. I know the subject well, and I want victory for U.S. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro says an attack on the country's Supreme Court and Interior Ministry was an attempt to oust him from power. The assault was thwarted and no one was killed. Maduro says a police helicopter fired on the pro-government court with grenades even as he was speaking on television. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis says Syria's government has taken seriously the U.S. warning against launching another chemical weapons attack. Mattis noted there has been no such attack since the White House surprise announcement Monday night. In that statement, the U.S. threatened Syria's government with a heavy price if it used chemical weapons. The U.S. says it saw active preparations to use them. And TV network ABC says it has reached a settlement with a South Dakota meat producer that filed a more than $1 billion lawsuit against the network over its reports on the company's lean, finely textured beef product critics dubbed pink slime. ABC spokeswoman Julie Townsend says the network has reached an amicable resolution of its dispute with the makers of the product. Dakota Dunes-based Beef Products sued the television network in 2012, saying ABC's coverage was a disinformation campaign that misled consumers into believing the product is unsafe. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 9:42.
On All Things Considered, the news from the people who make it.
This will be great if we get it done, and if we don't get it done, it's just going to be something that we're not going to like.
The big stories of the day and what to expect tomorrow, weekdays starting at 3.
I'm Tom Weber. Coming up at 11, recycling. You're doing it wrong. A recent article in USA Today is titled, "Recycling's in Trouble and It Might Be Your Fault." The issue? Throwing stuff in that we wish or think should be recycled, but really can't. We'll talk at 11.
On the podcast right now, what Attorney General Sessions is doing with criminal justice reform, why more women don't run for elective office. It's not for the reasons you think. And what the aliens want when they arrive, all on the podcast.
Programming on Minnesota Public Radio, supported by our listeners and by Sunrise Banks, winner of Minnesota Business Magazine's 2016 Community Impact Award for Workplace Giving. More at sunrisebanks.com. Programming supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, dedicated to promoting informed and engaged communities and committed to helping public radio advance quality journalism in the digital age. More at knightfoundation.org.
Back to the conversation now, and I'm going to pick right up on that question we had before the news break on costs. Ovik, Roy, did the Affordable Care Act do much to manage health care costs?
This is a fairly controversial topic in health policy circles. Stephen Brill famously wrote a lengthy book complaining that the political compromises that were made to get the bill over the finish line in Congress meant that the bill could not take on costs. There are other people who really strongly advocate the ACA, who believe that there are elements of the ACA that reduce costs. I'm more in the skeptical camp. But I think the Republican bill, while it does some things, particularly in the individual market, to reduce premiums, it doesn't do enough as much as any of us would hope to reduce the overall cost of health care. That's going to take bipartisan legislation, it seems to me, because the industry is so powerful, particularly the hospital industry, but all aspects of the health care industry are so powerful in our system that it really takes both parties coming to the table to try to do something about costs.
So, Gerald, the ACA on costs and then the Republican bill that would replace it.
Yeah, I tend to agree that I don't think there's strong evidence that the ACA has controlled overall health care spending. We have gone through a period in the last 5 years of much lower growth in health care spending in the United States. But a lot of that is still, at least most analysts seem to attribute that to the Great Recession and perhaps, you know, the increased coverage. But there's not strong evidence that the ACA controlled overall spending. I think it's important to remember that we, when we talk about premiums, premiums are only one piece of the healthcare marketplace. And so I always try to focus on what's going on with overall spending, because I can always reduce your individual premiums by offering you less and less generous health insurance. And all that means is I'm pushing more and more cost onto you. Jennifer Habercorn in the previous segment talked about a balloon, and that's exactly what healthcare spending is. If I reduce your premiums by offering you less generous benefits, that doesn't necessarily control healthcare spending. All it does is put other people at risk, including individuals. So the Republican bill is focused on premiums. It is not focused on overall healthcare spending. It's trying to segment the market. It's trying to basically reinstitute de facto discrimination by saying we're going to siphon people into these high-risk pools. And the problem with that is the high-risk pools will guarantee that there are certain individuals over time who will not have adequate coverage for their very expensive health care needs.
Call here from Beth in Burnham Center, Minnesota. Hi, Beth. Thanks for waiting.
Hey. Thanks for taking my call. So I'm going to take us completely away from the ACA and the new Senate plan and ask a question of your guests. If they know, what is the per capita spending for universal health care in, say, the UK or Canada or Cuba? As somebody my age in rural Minnesota, we're paying like $12,000 a year in premiums for high deductible plans. And I know, and I can't cite where I read the article, but the UK was about $5,000 per capita they were spending.
Okay, so I think we've got, Beth, I think we've got the essence of what you're looking for here. Gerald, do you have those numbers?
I don't have the exact numbers off the top of my head, but it's widely known that the U.S. spends more, about at least 50% more than any other nation in the world for health care on a comparison basis. And then that raises the question, are we getting better value for our dollar for all of the money that we're spending? It's other nations achieve savings through a variety of mechanisms, which are difficult to entertain in the United States because they're politically unpopular. But the fact is that most other countries can cover all of their citizens with good health care, excellent health care, at a much lower cost.
I actually do have some of the data in front of me, because in my big white paper on market-based universal coverage, which is called Transcending Obamacare, which your listeners can download from our website of our think tank, freeopt.org, we actually have a chart on just this question. And what it shows is that based on 2013 data, the data takes a while to generate, that's why it's about 4 years old, the U.S., in terms of government spending on health care, was $4,160 per capita. In Canada, it was $3,224 on a purchasing power parity adjusted basis. The UK was $2,762, so lower than the US, even though they had universal coverage. I would also point out one of the things in this table is that Switzerland, a more market-oriented approach that both the ACA exchanges and our own reform plan are based on, spends even less in terms of public spending per capita. It's at $2,241. As I mentioned, the UK was at $2,700. So the point that I make by bringing up that chart is that there is a conservative case for universal coverage, and that is to the degree that conservatives are very concerned about how much money the government is spending to subsidize coverage for the uninsured. Mm-hmm. If we had a system that was structured the right way, we could spend less money and cover more people. And that's a big focus of my own health reform efforts.
Ovik, I know you have to run. I thank you very much for the time and the insight. Thank you.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Gerald, and this kind of follows what Ovik was just saying. Mary on Twitter, how much of health care spending goes to insurance company profits, and how would single payer reduce that cost?
Again, I don't have the figures off the top of my head. Certainly, there are insurance companies that are making profits in the United States. There also continue to be nonprofit insurance companies as well. There is, because of our system with so many different insurers providing private coverage, it does increase the transactions cost and it increases the administrative expenses. There's no question that under a single payer system, administrative expenses could be substantially lower. There is debate within the policy community about how much savings could be achieved. But I think everyone's in agreement that there's certainly lots and lots of transactions in the current insurance market that would not be necessary under a single-payer system.
I want you to listen to something, Gerald, that we had a conversation last week with a couple of guests about the details of the Senate plan. And I will say this is before we saw all the specifics of it. But one of our guests, Dr. Kavita Patel of Brookings and Johns Hopkins, said that she thinks the ACA would have been more effective and that risk pool that we talked about at the beginning would have been more balanced universally if the individual mandate penalty had been higher. So I want you to listen to what she said about that.
A stiffer penalty from the beginning, because getting younger and healthier people to enroll when you only had like a $75 penalty in the beginning, it was laughable.
So make it harder for people to say they weren't going to get insurance.
Correct. Oh. I know that sounds very punitive, but we're talking about insurance risk pools.
Gerald, what do you think of that idea?
I tend to agree with her. I think that the ACA was based on the Massachusetts plan from 2006. The penalties there for not being insured were tied to the cost of a benchmark insurance plan. If you chose to remain uninsured, you had to pay essentially about half the cost of a typical policy. And that would drive people into the market. Why would I pay half the cost of a plan and get nothing? I may as well buy the insurance. So I tend to agree. I think that the penalties were too low at the beginning. Even under the Medicare program, when you sign up for Medicare, if you choose not to enroll in Medicare Part B at the time you're eligible and then change your mind later, you pay a 10% penalty for every year that you are out of the system for the rest of your life.
Wow. I didn't know what went on for the rest of your life.
That's
interesting.
It does.
Huh. Call here from Carrie in St. Paul. Hi, Carrie, your question for Gerald.
Yes, I'm wondering how the bill is addressing the issue of lifetime limits for insurance companies, because if you have a serious health problem like a heart condition or a chronic illness such as MS, because of the high cost of medications, you could easily reach those limits long before your life is over.
Okay. Lifetime limits, Gerald. What's your understanding?
Yeah, so good question. The bill says that the ACA insurance provisions such as this remain in effect unless a state applies for a waiver, basically permission from the federal government to change the market rules. So the only way that those could go away is if you lived in a state that applied for a waiver and the state wanted to do away with those provisions. And believe me, there are states that will want these waivers so they can do away with these kinds of provisions and offer, quote unquote, less expensive policies that put people at more risk.
One of the things that members of the Senate, Republican members of the Senate, said yesterday, even as they were announcing a delay of the vote, is that they feel urgency because, quote unquote, Obamacare is collapsing. That's kind of been a mantra of the Republican Party now for years. Is that true? And take California out of the mix, okay? As you look across the and you know why, as you look across the rest of the country, do the facts support that?
Partially, but here's a case where politics almost supersede the facts. The fact is that there is more instability in the markets this year because there was a provision of the Affordable Care Act that was phased out. That provision was what Republicans are now calling invisible risk, high risk pools. The federal government was providing health insurers with insurance or reinsurance if they enrolled individuals under the Affordable Care Act who were very expensive and had high costs, the federal government was providing back-end what's known as stop-loss insurance, basically. Those payments stopped at the end of 2016, and as a result, insurers increased premiums to account for the loss of that reinsurance fund. If I were advising, if I were in a position to control this, I would have said those payments should have never stopped. They're going to be necessary into the indefinite future because there are too many markets with where there are only a few thousand people enrolled. So those payments, I think, were really necessary.
I really appreciate the time and the insight. This is complicated stuff, and our goal is to try to be as, you know, transparent and explanatory as we can be, and you helped us with that. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Gerald Kaminsky is a professor in Department of Health Policy and Management at UCLA. I will say this, many more conversations about healthcare to come. I know a lot of you didn't get your questions answered. We have a show planned for a week from Monday. Just a lot of discussion here as the healthcare debate continues.